And we meet three young men of royal lineage, back in Judah, the best and the brightest, whom Nebuchadnezzar has had trained to work in his government in their new unwanted home. The Babylonians worked hard to assimilate their captives, and so those men's Hebrew names have been replaced as a way of toning down their Jewish identity. But back in chapter 1, we met them refusing to eat the king's non-kosher food, insisting instead they only serve vegetables and water. So where they can fit in, they do, but they resist the pressure to break Jewish laws or be disloyal to Yahweh. Now, scholars think that this account became popular some 400 years later during the persecution of the Jews, which took place under the Seleucid Empire. And Epiphanes the Illustrious, privately called Epimanes the Madman, by the Jews, put great pressure on them to Hellenize, that is, to adopt Greek ways. In fact, our New Testament is written in Greek because Greek had become the universal language at this point. And under the Seleucids, circumcising your son, observing the Sabbath, celebrating Jewish festivals, they all became punishable by death. And the Seleucids went so far as to slaughter pigs in the temple, and they erected a statue of one of their gods in the holy place. So it was a tough, tough time to be a faithful Jew, and this account from Daniel was an inspiration. Continues to be an inspiration, both to the Jews of Jesus' day who are living under Roman occupation, and to us today and whatever adversity we face as we seek to follow Jesus. So as you heard, King Nebuchadnezzar had a giant golden statue of himself erected, and everyone's supposed to bow down to it as a loyalty test. It's really not a lot that's new in this world. And of course, this is complete anathema to any observant Jew. But the penalty is death by fire. Well, eventually our three heroes are caught, and we don't know what lengths they might have gone to try to avoid being noticed, but certain Chaldeans report them to the king, and Nebuchadnezzar demands that they appear before him, challenges them to bow down, warns them of the consequences if they don't, and he finishes by saying to them, "Who is the God that will deliver you out of my hands?" Well, I think the reply is the most exciting thing about this exciting story because it challenges us. You know, we expect God to behave well, but we know that humans don't always behave well. But they say, "Oh, Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to present a defense to you in this matter. You're not the one we answer to. If our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire and out of your hand, O king, let him deliver us. But if not, be it known to you, O God, that we will not serve your gods and we will not worship the golden statue." I'm guessing perhaps they had thought this through in advance, knowing it might happen, because that's a pretty articulate response under a great deal of pressure. But see, they understand that serving God will require them to do difficult things with uncertain outcomes. Well, Nebuchadnezzar is enraged. How dare they talk to him this way? And he has them thrown into the fire. Those who toss them in are overcome by the fire themselves. And then he watches as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego walk around inside the furnace along with a fourth one who has the appearance of a god. Called out of the fire, Nebuchadnezzar lauds their God and gives them promotions. So, happy ending for them, although, of course, they're still working for a madman who just wanted to kill them. And we don't see that Nebuchadnezzar is himself greatly improved by this because now, instead of having people executed by fire who refuse to bow down to his statue, now people who speak out against the God of Meshach, Shadrach, and Abednego will be torn limb from limb and have their houses destroyed. So, you know, Nebuchadnezzar is still very willing to misuse his power. Well, our three heroes choose the difficult path with the uncertain outcome out of loyalty to God. And indeed, God is with them, perhaps as an angel, perhaps an Old Testament appearance of the Christ. But God wins the day on their behalf, surprising and impressing a pagan king. God with us in our suffering is certainly a Christmas or an Advent theme. God, who is not adverse to asking us to do difficult things with uncertain outcomes, asks nothing that he's not done himself, coming in the second person of the Trinity to be born among us as a servant and die on our behalf. Well, in this account, there's a miraculous intervention and a relatively happy ending. That was not always the case for Jews suffering persecution under the Seleucids, or later under Hitler. Many, many Jews were killed for their loyalty to Yahweh, while others made things easy for themselves by assimilating. Well, some years ago, back when he had more time on his hands, my son Eric wrote a theology blog regularly, Jawbone of the Ass, and this is that's from the book of Judges. In this one piece called Your Best Life Martyred, he wrote, he was writing about James the Just's martyrdom, which happened in the 60s. James, of course, is Jesus' brother, leader of the church in Jerusalem, who's thrown to his death. And Eric writes, what part of James being thrown to his death is his best life then? The part where James is entirely reoriented on the work of God and not on himself? The part where James walks into martyrdom knowing that he does so? The part where James has right desires? And later, talking about other assorted heroes of the faith, he writes, God's work on them, in them, and with them did not result in wonderful things happening to them all the time. Instead, it resulted in them becoming slowly wonderful people. The sort of people who have the courage not to bow down to a golden statue. The sort of people who are willing to do difficult things with uncertain outcomes and trust God with the results.